boundaries of what I'm comfortable with in terms of relating to. You know, we'll see some slides on here going forward 1,000 years, back a couple thousand years. It's amazing. I mean, when you think about everything that's happened in human history over the last 50 years, then you think about what's happened over the last 100 years or 300 years or 1,000 years, and you try to put all that into perspective, it's just, I have a hard time relating to it. Most of us can't remember where we were more than a couple of years ago, and most of us have no idea where we'll be in a few years down the road here. Our own perspective is so small, maybe 5 years, in where we're kind of have that consciousness of time around us. And so when you get into these climate change cycles here that last hundreds of years, thousands of years, hundreds of millions of years, it's really hard to wrap your head around. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so hard for folks to come to grips with what we're doing to this planet. Essentially, what we are, we're taking a carbon cycle that naturally takes hundreds of millions of years to complete in terms of the cycle of the Earth, and we're basically taking that 100 million year old carbon and we're bringing it up in the span of a few hundred years. And so we've short-circuited everything, and so in essence there we've kind of driven the natural cycles out of whack a little bit. Anyway, before we get going on the actual science here, I have an experiment that I'm kind of interested in, because internet and social media has changed a lot about the way that people think. And this is something that I do with students in a lot of my classes. And it's very interesting working with millennials. I'll just leave it at that. So this is a statement here. Everyone has a right to their own opinion, therefore all opinions are equal. How many of you agree with that? How many of you disagree with that? Okay. When I'm in my classroom, the initial response is that about two-thirds of the class will agree with this statement. And then after we've had a chance to discuss it a little bit more, then it will maybe swing the other way, where there's about two-thirds of it who will disagree with it and one-third that will agree with it. But it shows kind of a shifting way that people get their information, the way that people process their information. There's sort of a political correctness about allowing everybody to express their opinions. I mean, Twitter has sort of flattened everything. The Facebook has sort of flattened everything, where every voice is equal. And so it's amazing to me that so many students believe that this is true, that the fact that, you know, that all opinions are equal. And of course, there's quality that has to go behind those opinions. And so, if you've got problems with your brain, I mean, and issues, medical issues with your brain, and you go talk to a neurosurgeon or you go talk to a plumber, well, whose opinion is better? Probably the neurosurgeon's opinion is better. So there's an essence of quality that has to go into these opinions. And so one of the issues that comes along with science in general in this country here is that it's just been flattened. It's like everybody has an opinion and it's all treated as if it's equal. And so that it's kind of a very disturbing trend to me in terms of trying to teach science to students and in general. And it's one of those things that I haven't wrapped my head around it yet, exactly what it means and how to get around it, other than to work through this question every time I get a new class, just to let them know that for every truth, there's an infinite number of lies. And you have to go out there and you have to question everything and you have to fact check everything. And you have to find people that you trust, because you cannot possibly fact check everything. So you have to find people that you can trust and rely on their opinions to fact check things for you. But you know, the internet is so filled with misinformation right now, and some of it is true and some of it is not. And so you have to be really, really careful about what it is that you're looking at. So in terms of the climate change science here right now, feel free to ask questions at any point here. What I'm trying to do here is just to work you through, sort of start from the basic, most fundamental building blocks, and just kind of keep stretching it, and see what point you start to lose interest, or what part you start to have more and more questions about things here too. So it's just trying to build it from the base up. That's all this is. That's all I'm trying to do with this particular talk here. But absolutely ask questions all along the way. Anybody recognize this photo?
Holden Lake.
Yeah, it's Holden Lake. And the reason why I use this particular slide, it's probably not the best slide that I could use, but is because Holden Village and the Heights is sort of like the source of my first midlife crisis. And my first midlife crisis came about up at Lyman Lake. The first time I went to Lyman Lake, we sat at Upper Lyman and we watched the glacier calving off into the lake, breaking off, iceberg floats away, beautiful blue. It was a beautiful thing. Now you go to Lyman Lake there, and of course the glacier's receded way up the mountainside, and that's all related to climate change. I mean, you know, when I was young, I had this idea that that the world was going to be the same forever. And I think here up at Holden and seeing the Lyman Glacier disappearing was sort of my first realization that while it's changing in my lifetime, it's not the same forever. And that was really hard for me to come to grips with too. So this isn't the Lyman Glacier, but there are glaciers up there on Bonanza. And this is kind of just a reminder of the fact that climate change, personal to me, my world is changing. I don't want it to change, but it is. And so the background for this is all Holden Village. So I've been giving this talk here for several years, and I went through and tried to update slides and things like that too, but the Holden background is always part of it for me. So at the root of the problem here, it's all just a heat budget, a heat balance. We've got incoming solar radiation, 342 watts per square meter, that's average. And we have 107 that's going out by reflection, and we have another 235 that's going out by radiation. So 107 and 235 equals 342. And when those two things are equal, everything's copacetic. We're good. The problem is, of course, that it's more complicated than that. And so we have all these different ways that this energy balance can be affected. So we've got reflection of some of this energy by the clouds, by aerosols, by atmospheric gases, about 77 watts per square meter that are reflected by the clouds. We have another 30 that are reflected by the surface of the Earth. We have 168 that are absorbed by the surface. We have another 67 that's absorbed by the atmosphere. Then we have some of this energy goes back up as thermals. We have evapotranspiration that takes energy and puts it back up into the atmosphere. We've got surface radiation here. This is just every black body emits a radiation, so all of us emit radiation, so there's a spectrum of radiation emitting from all of us that we could measure and characterize based on our temperature of 98.6 degrees. There's some that manages to get through the clouds and out into space. There's some energy that gets captured by the clouds and then re-emitted at lower wavelengths out into space. There's some where we get back radiation. It goes up and it reflects back onto the surface. So all of these different things factor into that 107 and that 235 that go out. And if we change any of it, then we change the heat balance. So what happens if we put more clouds in the sky? More reflection. So if you get more reflection from the clouds, what does that do to the temperature on the planet?
It
will cool it. But there's clouds over here. So what happens if we put more clouds on the planet?
Keep the heat.
So now we've got more clouds to absorb energy. We've got more clouds to reflect energy. So is putting clouds in the air a good thing or a bad thing?
Yes.
So this is how quickly it gets complicated. It's a simple heat balance, but it gets very, very complicated because we've got two different things here working in two different directions on whether we've got net energy going out or net energy coming in. I like to compare this a little bit to just a house. For example, you've got a house and you've got a furnace that's on continuously. It's always putting out the same amount of heat. You've got insulation in the attic. And your house presumably is going to be at a constant temperature. What happens if you put more insulation in the attic? The house gets warmer. What happens if you open up a window? The house gets cooler. What happens if you close the vent in one of the rooms? So that room is going to get cooler, the rest of the house is going to get warmer. So one of the things that's sort of confusing about climate change in general to a lot of folks is this issue. It's like, well, is it global warming or climate change? You know, we had a really nasty winter. Is that climate change? I mean, I thought everything was supposed to be getting warmer. Well, it's the same as a house. We have different mechanisms for moving that energy around. If you think about where the intensity of the sun is most focused, it's coming in at the equator. So the equator is the part that's heating up, and then we have atmospheric thermals carrying the energy from the equator toward the poles. We have ocean currents carrying energy from the equator toward the poles. The Gulf Stream is carrying lots of energy toward the poles. And so those are like heating ducts, essentially, in a house. If you shut off the Gulf current, what's going to happen to Europe?
Colder.
It's going to get colder. It's going to go into a mini ice age. I mean, maybe it'll start to look a lot more like Siberia. I mean, it's at the same elevation. Lots of parts of Europe are at the same elevation or same latitude as Siberia, but they're not cold like Siberia, and they're not cold because they've got the Gulf Stream bringing all that heat from the equator up there. So it can be simplified like a house. I mean, there's a lot of different ways that you can manipulate a house to cool one area but heat another, even though the furnace is always staying on. So that's basically what we're looking at here, is all the different ways that we can change things. So this reflection by the surface, that's a term called albedo. And what happens, for example, if we put more snow and ice on the ground? We increase our albedo and we start to bounce more off into space. What happens if we take that snow and ice and we start to cover it with soot from burning, from fossil fuel burning, for example? It starts to decrease that albedo and we start to change, we start to have less that's reflected by the surface. Changing it from forest to cropland, that's another change in albedo. Desertification is another change in albedo. Changing to from a forest to an urban area, that changes the reflectivity as well. So there's all these different things that change the reflection by the surface. Up here, we have reflection by clouds, aerosols. So aerosols, we'll talk about this a little bit. Maybe we'll leave that one for a little bit later. But you know, there's a very interesting, we have an interesting relationship with aerosols. We're kind of a dusty, polluting kind of people, and so we've got aerosols up in the atmosphere as well. So we have lots of different things up in the atmosphere. So anyway, that's what we're looking at primarily here. It's just the heat budget. And anything we do to change any part of that heat budget there will change whether we've got more energy coming in than going out or more energy going out than coming in. Question?
With the clouds, whether they're reflecting or absorbing energy, does elevation matter or does it not really?
Yeah, I'm not an atmospheric scientist, but my guess is that the higher the clouds, the better the reflectivity would be on this term, and the lower the clouds, probably the more heat absorption that you would get. That would be my gut instinct, but I'm not 100% confident on that. Other questions? So the most basic physical principle here, this concept of greenhouse gas and greenhouse warming is based on, is the idea that every compound will absorb energy at very specific wavelengths. And so, for example, there up at the very top, we've got methane on here. And so if you got yourself a bottle of methane in a quartz container here, because quartz is very good for putting optical stuff, for putting electromagnetic radiation through it. So if you get yourself a quartz container, and put methane in it, and then you shine a light through that thing, and you scan it, you range it from 0.1 microns all the way up to 30 microns, and you measure what comes out on the other side. For most of these bands here, you won't absorb anything. But when you get up around 5 microns here, well, like I say, 3 microns here, you're going to start to absorb some energy. And when you get up to around 8 microns here, you're going to absorb energy. It's just a physical chemical property of methane. I don't know how much you know about chemistry or how much you remember about chemistry, but there's electrons in there, and these electrons basically jump from one level to the next, and it's very quantized. They take a very specific amount of energy to get from one level to the other level, and unless they're getting exactly that energy coming into that molecule, they won't jump. And so this is basically telling us that In methane, it needs the energy at 3 and it needs the energy at 8 microns to match that electron jump. That's what's happening. But it's very repeatable. You can do this in any lab where you are able to shine a light and measure what's coming through on the other side. So you can see the same thing for nitrous oxide. It's got a slightly different pattern here. We've got oxygen, ozone here on this line here. So now on the first two there, there's not a whole lot that's being absorbed at these low energy, or see these low wavelengths. So short wavelengths means higher energy. Long wavelengths means lower energy. It's kind of a little bit flipped from what you would like it to be to make it more intuitive. So oxygen, ozone is really, really good at absorbing energy at these low wavelength, high energy bands. And of course, carbon dioxide, that's sort of like the main character in our story today. Then we have water vapor that's got all of its things, and so you can sum all these things together, and this is what the total atmosphere looks like when you shine light or shine this electromagnetic radiation through there. It absorbs in all these different bands in here. It lets it through in all of these different bands here. So the, in red here, what I have marked off is the solar radiation band. Again, it's a black body radiator. It has a very specific spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that comes off. And since it's a lot hotter than the Earth is, it's a lot shorter wavelengths. And this is the radiation that goes back out by the Earth in green. It's a lot cooler, so those radiation bands are longer wavelength, lower energy. This is kind of what it looks like from the perspective of the sun. So this gray line here is that theoretical band of black body radiation that comes out. The yellow is what's measured at the top of the atmosphere by satellites. The red is what's actually measured at sea level. And so you can see that at these lower wavelengths here, we've got a lot of energy that's been scrubbed out by ozone. We've got a band in here from oxygen, water, CO2, more water. So for the energy coming in here, CO2 is not really a big player because it's not absorbing energy in that right band wavelength. And another point that I need to make about this here too is that just the property of absorbing energy is neither good nor bad. It just is. We need for some greenhouse gases to be working on this planet in order to keep it warm enough for us to be able to inhabit it. If we got rid of all greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we wouldn't have a livable planet. It would be like Mars. Conversely, or not conversely, but along those same lines here, this ozone is doing us a big favor by scrubbing energy. It's absorbing all that UV radiation at the very high energy, low wavelength, low wavelength region of this spectra. If this wasn't happening here, life again would be really hard to exist on this planet because everything would just be getting burned up by UV radiation. And so, you know, I mean, most of you, I would assume, remember the whole scare about the ozone hole back 20, 30 years ago when they discovered that there was this ozone hole that was getting bigger and bigger and bigger in Antarctica, especially over the Antarctic region there, and they were able to trace that to chlorofluorocarbons, all the refrigerants that we were using. And so there was an international treaty that was put together in order to limit the amount of these chlorofluorocarbons that were put up into the atmosphere. And now over time, that ozone hole has gradually been getting smaller and smaller. It takes on the order of 100 years or so before we can get a complete recovery of the ozone layer. But over time, it's been getting better. So absorption of this energy is neither good nor bad. It just depends on if it's in the wrong time, the wrong place. So this is an example of good absorption for us. Greenhouse gases in general, just to keep the planet warm enough for human life and life in general, that's a good thing. So the problem is when it's too much. I don't want to say everything in moderation because there are some things where you've got to do it all the way. You can't just moderate. So this is just another way of looking at the same thing here too, where we've got the radiation that's from the sun versus the radiation. So this is the red is the radiation coming in from the sun after it's been scrubbed by the atmosphere, and the blue is the radiation that's being emitted by the Earth after it's again been scrubbed by the atmosphere. Any questions about any of this so far? Does it seem reasonable? Does it seem believable? Yeah.
If we didn't have the excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, would the volume under, the area under both those curves be equal?
So it's a little bit more complicated. No, this is not. This is not the area.
Would we be emitting as much radiation as we're bringing in? Because
if we didn't
have the excess greenhouse gas,
we would be. Yeah, that blue spectrum would be a little bit bigger. We'd be sending out a little bit more. Yes. That the question, basic
yeah.
question. Okay.
So the change of regulations, like on appliances and things like this, has made a difference?
In terms of the greenhouse gases or in terms of like the ozone layer?
The ozone.
So the ozone, yes, changing to moving away from chlorofluorocarbons to other kinds of refrigerants. That was the biggest thing. And aerosol cans used to use chlorofluorocarbons as well. So it was really about trying to eliminate the use of chlorofluorocarbons.
So that has been measured and it has made a difference.
Yeah, it has. It has. I mean, it's essentially. I mean, you know, that's why you don't hear about the ozone hole anymore. Is because we essentially solved it. And the amazing thing about that is that it was the U.S. that led the way. The U.S. was the one that led the way on these regulations and international agreement to limit these chlorofluorocarbons and solve the problem. Yeah.
Is it, this is ranging into a little bit of a different side of that, but I think I've understood that part of the reason we were able to do that so quickly is that industry had not mobilized a large lobbying campaign. Is that your understanding, or is that outside the bounds of what you want to talk about?
Well, there is. I do have one slide on here about following the money. Yeah, I think that's part of it, but I think it just didn't have such a huge foothold. I mean, that's the main issue there. It wasn't the main economic driver.
That fossil fuels
are right now. But there are also many, many other cases like that too. Like, I mean, the whole Flint, Michigan, I don't want to get too far off the beaten track here, but the Flint, Michigan episode, all of you, I presume, are familiar with all of the lead in Flint and all of the problems that has caused. When you look back at how all of that evolved, it's just criminal. The lead industry was, I mean, they mastered the art of miscommunication and misinformation long before the cigarette industry got a hold of it, and long before the fossil fuel industry got a hold of it before. But I mean, lead—they were marketing lead as something that was good for you, and that's one of the reasons why we have lead pipes all over the place. I mean, and they knew for a long, long time that lead was not a good thing, but they mobilized. They didn't want to shut down their business, and so they basically had this misinformation campaign, and that's how we ended up with lead pipes and lead solder all over the eastern U.S., and so it's going to be kind of interesting to see what the fallout is from that. But you're right. I mean, there is that aspect of it as well. Other questions or comments? So that's the basic idea here, that everything in the atmosphere absorbs energy, and it's an easy to measure that property. It scales roughly to the concentration. It's not linear, per se, so it's not like if you double the amount of carbon dioxide, you're going to double the amount of energy that's absorbed. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but it will go up. So more carbon dioxide means more energy absorbed. Less carbon dioxide means less energy absorbed. It's a pretty simple one-to-one relationship in that regard. We could look to see what's happening to the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, and we can make our own judgments here about what's going to happen, what the cause and effect is going to be. So this is CO2 in Mauna Loa. I don't remember exactly the story about how this got started and why they started looking at CO2 in Mauna Loa there, but you know it's a pretty good place to go because it's a lot less complicated in terms of urban areas and things like that. It's out in the middle of the ocean, and so you can kind of get a cleaner signature, a cleaner idea about what's happening with atmospheric levels. And so, you know, they started measuring here in the late 50s, and over time it starts to go up and up and up. And you see that sawtooth pattern in there. Anybody here know why that sawtooth pattern exists? Yeah?
It's the photosynthesis in the northern hemisphere that takes up.
Right. So during the spring and summertime, that CO2 is dropping. In the wintertime, fall and wintertime, when all the deciduous trees drop their leaves, that CO2 signal goes back up again. This is a physical measurement. This is not guesswork. This is an actual measurement. We know without a doubt that CO2 is going up in the atmosphere. And we know without a doubt that it's coming from fossil fuels. Any idea how we know that the CO2 is coming from fossil fuels? There are isotopes. Carbon has different isotopes, C13 isotopes, C14 isotopes. And the signature of fossil fuel, it's C14 dead. There is no carbon-14 in fossil fuels. So when you put fossil fuel carbon up into the atmosphere, it dilutes the C14 signature of the CO2 that's up there, and we can measure that dilution. So we know from C14 that this increase in CO2 is not coming from volcanoes. It's not coming from anything else in particular. It's coming from fossil fuels because it's got that C14 signature, that C14 dead signature that's going along with it. So we know that CO2 is rising. We know that it's coming from fossil fuels. We can have a look at some of the other concentrations of other types of greenhouse gases as well. We've got methane in here in blue and nitrous oxide in black. Methane, I guess depending on how you do the math, maybe has 86 times the greenhouse warming potential that carbon dioxide does, and I forget what the warming potential is of nitrous oxide, but it's also many, many, many times higher than CO2. Those two are on, let's see, the methane is on this scale here, it's in parts per billion. The nitrous oxide on here is also in parts per billion, but it's on this axis on this scale, and then the CO2 here is in parts per million. So the CO2 is about 1,000 times more concentrated than these other two. So CO2 is still the big dog, just because there's so much more that's being put into the atmosphere than methane or nitrous oxide here, but they all have their contribution to the problem here. So this record goes back to the year zero. It's a 2,000-year record. How do we get 2,000-year records? There were no monks out there in the year 500 measuring methane or nitrous oxide or carbon dioxide. So how do we get those kind of measurements?
Ice cores.
So ice cores trap air bubbles in them. And those air bubbles, if you can date the ice core using geologic events, for example, we have a rough history of volcanic action. And so you can go down in these ice cores and you can find dusty layers where volcanoes happen and they lay down a layer of dust. That's one of the ways that you can try to date a core. So you date a core using things like volcanic deposits. You can use isotopes and many other different things too. But you date that core with using those kinds of historical markers there. Then you can section the ice core and you can take that ice core and you can melt it. And whatever that gas released, that's a little snapshot of what the atmosphere was like back in the day. Yeah?
I'm kind of new to this topic, but okay. What's causing all the methane in our atmosphere?
The increase in methane? There's many, many different things that can deal with. I mean, I guess it's sort of like the extent of I'm losing my words here. Cows. What's the word for cows? Cattle produce methane, and so when we start, when we start to build up our operations with cattle, there's a lot of methane that comes from cattle. When we do fracking, we release a lot of methane that comes off from that.
Permafrost
thaw has the potential for doing that. Wetlands. Depending on how wetlands, rice paddies are a form of wetlands. Depending on how wetlands are managed, they can release methane. And just about any land use you do. So anytime you, so there's methane coming off of off agricultural fields. And so if you switch from corn to beans and beans back to corn, for example, those will have different nitrogen signatures to it or methane signatures to it. So it's just a large part of it is related to agriculture. And just in terms of how we do that.
But a big one that isn't thought about very much is permafrost melting. And there's a lot of methane trapped.
There is some permafrost thaw. I mean, there's these methane clathrates that everybody worries about too. Methane is kind of an interesting beast because methane has a lifetime of only about 10 years in the atmosphere before it converts to CO2. And so for methane to be a problem, it has to be a continuous, if you get a one-time pulse of methane, within 10 years, it's going to be scrubbed from the atmosphere and that effect will go away. And so what the significance of this increase in methane is that these are continuous sources that are being released, that we've just increased the background, this continuous level of methane that's going up into the atmosphere. Nitrous oxide is a little bit more on the nasty side from the standpoint that's got a lifetime in the atmosphere of about 200 years. So when we put nitrous oxide into the atmosphere, that's going to be around for a while. I mean, you know, obviously multiple generations, 5-6 generations, depending on how you want to call it, kind of generation. So nitrous oxide, to me, is kind of a little bit more of a bigger problem in the sense that it's just going to be around a long time. And of course, carbon dioxide is, in addition is to the fact that we're putting so much of it up there, it's going to be around for hundreds of thousands of years before it can actually really get scrubbed out all the way. Other questions? This is good. But it makes sense. Right now, you're still on board with me. You have a general believability that we can measure these things based on ice cores and go in there and try to get those gases out. So we know that these gases are increasing. We can measure them. We know the difference or how much they've increased. We know what the relative proportion of energy that they're going to absorb based on their how much they're increasing. So we can just do the math here and calculate. How much of a difference are these things going to make in our energy budget that we went to on that very first page? And so for CO2, up at the very top there, we can see that the radiative forcing that calculated is about 1.68 watts per meter squared. And so we were talking about 342 coming in and 342 going out. So our CO2 is responsible for increasing the amount that's absorbed or stays on the Earth by about 1.68. So what is that, like 0.5%, something like that, maybe? Am I doing the math on that correctly? I mean, so it's a little tweak, but it's measurable. It's making a difference. Methane, we can do that kind of a calculation as well, and that's in the second column there. We can do that for those same chlorofluorocarbons that are causing problems with the ozone layer. Well, it turns out they're also greenhouse gases, and they're still there because they have a lifetime on the order of 50 to 100 years. So it takes a while for the chlorofluorocarbons to get scrubbed. So those are up there. The N2O here, we can do that calculation with all these different things. We talked a little bit about aerosols on that first slide, the fact that we've got reflection that's happening based on aerosols. So we can also calculate how much we've increased the level of aerosols in the atmosphere. And these aerosols in the atmosphere have the net effect of reflecting more energy. And so they tend to run counter. So not everything that we're doing, not all of our pollution in the atmosphere is driving it in one direction. Some of our pollution is driving it in the other direction. So we can make those kinds of calculations based on aerosols and how much extra reflectivity they have. Here's that one that we talked a little bit about earlier here, black carbon on snow. That tends to decrease the reflectivity off the surface of the planet there, so that's going to have a net increase in the amount of energy that stays on the planet. This one here is kind of a fascinating one. Contrails, that's all of the jets and airplanes that we have in the atmosphere, they actually produce enough clouds. So there's the contrails themselves that they produce, and every time you look up in the sky and you see that jet stream that's going across there, some of those actually spin off and create cirrus clouds. And so those net clouds that they put into the atmosphere there have an impact on, we have enough air traffic in there that have an impact on this. And so then we've got surface albedo here, and this is largely related to land use, and so over time converting from natural landscapes into agricultural landscapes and urban landscapes, we've actually increased the albedo, made it a little bit more reflective in all those changes that we've been doing. And then this is the solar irradiance. So this would be the nature part that has had an impact since. And so this is from, I forget what the time scale on this one here is. I mean, this is basically the industrial age here. And so over that time, the solar irradiance has changed just a little bit. So we've increased from 342 to 342.1, for example, over that amount of time. So we have all these different radiative forcings here that you can basically just do the math. It's just chemical physical properties, figure out what it's doing. This is another more simplified perspective on it. On the very right, it has the confidence level of these calculations. So there's been many, many scientists who spent entire careers working on this problem here, trying to come up with the right calculations for these various things here too. So up at the top we have CO2 here, and the confidence level on that is very high. Just, you know, there's so much of it, and we know the chemistry of it so well that it's pretty easy to make that calculation there and have a lot of confidence that we've got it right. Other well-mixed greenhouse gases, very high confidence. Ozone, some of the things that we have a little bit less confidence on are some of these feedbacks, aerosol cloud interactions. You put aerosols into the sky there, does it tend to increase clouds or decrease clouds? Well, if it seeds the clouds, then you've got rain, and that has a tendency to decrease the clouds. But aerosols can actually help form the clouds there too. So it's a little bit more complicated on some of these feedbacks on what exactly is happening with these different parts. And so then you end up with something that's got a lower confidence level on it, for example. And so then we put add together all the anthropogenic things together here, and we compare it to the solar irradiance here. And I mean, it's pretty clear that the main driver here in terms of changes in radiative forcing here has been coming from anthropogenic sources. Jen?
So when people deny climate change, or at least deny the causes of it, they always throw up and say, well, scientists disagree. So what is it that scientists are disagreeing on? The fact of that carbon dioxide comes from the fossil fuels, or what is it that's disputed among scientists then?
Among scientists?
Yeah.
Or among hacks.
Yeah.
Among scientists, there is very little disagreement. I mean, you know, 97%. There's 97% consensus on it, and only, you know, in the scientific literature, there's 3% not. But I mean, you know, you take 100 people and you throw out any topic out there, and you'll probably find one or two or three of them that will disagree, just based on principle.
So they're, in a way, they're not legitimate scientists.
No, and I mean, I can't speak with authority about their credentials, but what I can tell you is that any time I've gone and seen an article and they cite some expert that has has a different opinion about it, and I go and I look on Web of Science to see what they've published, they have either published something completely different. I mean, they're not in the climate change field, they're not publishing on that field, or they have nothing published at all. I mean, so in general, when I've gone through and I've specifically tried to track down their records just to see what their credibility is, there's generally nothing there. And so it's really hard for me to take that. I mean, so I think that, you know, expecting there to be 100% consensus on anything, it's just not very realistic. But 97% is pretty darn good. And I mean, there's not a whole lot in this world that we're you know, that we have a higher confidence level than 97% on. So I don't really honestly know what it is that they're saying. I mean, generally I guess I'm not gonna put it up here. I mean, I can show you a list of all the different things, the reasons that people have for trying to deny climate change, and maybe if we have enough time here at the end, you can kind of scan through the list and see what you think of them. But it just ranges from all sorts of things. Like, for example, there was that scandal about that email scandal from the climate research unit in the UK. I don't know, the hacked emails were supposedly, that was, you know, I don't remember even what the content of the emails were at this point, but they were pointing to that big scandal, that was a scandal that was a hoax, that even the climate change scientists admitted that it wasn't real, and they were admitting in these emails, but of course, when you do the full investigation, there was nothing there. And so it was all overblown. Or, you know, there's the debate about ice in Antarctica, and so there's some folks who say, well, there's more ice forming in Antarctica. How can there be climate change going on? Well, it's the difference between ice that's formed on the water versus ice that's formed on the land. Yes, there's more ice that's formed on the water, but that has no impact in terms of really in terms of sea level rise, for example. I mean, the ice on the land is disappearing, and so that has more implications. And so and again, it comes back to that whole idea about, if you shut off the vent in one room of your house, it gets colder while the rest of the house gets warmer. And so we can't expect for everything around the globe to be getting evenly warmer. It just doesn't work that way. There's too many different complications in that. Other questions?
So should we be doing more to refute these alternative facts that the scientific community and maybe the religious community as well?
Doing more, I guess you kind of have to define what doing more is. I mean, you know, there's plenty of research out there that shows that for strongly held beliefs, the more you try to educate or reason, the more strongly they dig in and it makes it actually worse. And that's not just about climate change, that's about anything. I mean, you know, if you've got a very strong belief about anything in particular and I try to convince you otherwise, you'll dig in your heels. That's just the way it is. And so when it's a belief, there's not a lot that you can do about it. I mean, it's sad to say, you want to do something about it, but there's not a lot that you can. There's other interesting research about how to try to convince people of you know, that their facts are wrong, for example. And the best that you can do is to try to get them to recall a really, really, really happy childhood memory, and then it softens up their brain. it's fascinating. I mean, that's true for any of us. I mean, there's something about that connection with a really happy childhood memory that just makes us more receptive to reason and to logic and to be, you know, to take on a new perspective. It's kind of weird. I've never tried it in a class before. I mean, we can try it now. Yeah.
I know sometimes when you buy an airplane ticket, some airlines are putting a carbon tax on or giving you an option to buy a carbon tax. Is there anything to that?
I don't know how that money is spent. That's kind of a dodgy business in general, though, the idea about, you know, paying extra money to offset your carbon footprint.
Right.
You're taking a big leap of faith on how they're doing their accounting, on how they make that happen. So I can't tell you for sure on that. I haven't gone down that rabbit hole before. Other questions? So let's see, where are we going from here? So we add all these forcings together here, and the forcings are in red, and we compare that to the observed temperature that we have, and that one's in black. And I mean, it's not perfect. They're not perfect sync here, but I mean, it's capturing the general trends here, that when we put these forcings in there, there's nothing else that seems to explain this. You can't explain this with changes in solar radiation. You can't explain it with any other thing. The only one that seems to explain, that has the ability to explain this increase in temperature here, is when we put together all these forcings and we look at what it does. So this is an example then, you know, taking all of those calculations that we've done, trying to apply it to the actual temperature record here, and this is the match that we get. Any ideas about why we ended up get some of these dips?
Right, I was wondering.
Is that during war?
During war, it's not war related.
Volcano?
It's volcanoes. So like Pinatubo went off in 1991, and it injected aerosols way up into the stratosphere, and it increased the reflectivity of the atmosphere, and it led to global cooling for 3 or 4 years. That's about how long those aerosols can hang out in the stratosphere before they get scrubbed out. So some people think that, you know, if we can just get a volcano to go off every 3 or 4 years, that it will solve problems. But that's an oversimplification, because what we, you know, when you put all that aerosols up in the atmosphere, you change the system again. And so what happens then is that you put India into a drought, and you put Africa into a drought, and you put, you know, so you end up changing precipitation patterns all around the world. So when those volcanoes happen there, it's miserable for certain parts, for large parts of the world, for 2 or 3 or 4 years afterward. The rest of the world may be cooling off, but there's some world parts of the world that really, really suffer by doing that. So that's one of those crazy things that, you know, people talk about, geoengineering, that we can solve this by putting aerosols up into the stratosphere, and all we need to do is just, and, you know, so there's some ideas out there about getting a big tube and putting a tube and running it all the way up into the stratosphere, so all we need to do is just to keep pushing aerosols through that tube up into the stratosphere, and that we can keep our world cool. There's a business model for that. And so, you know, it probably would keep things cool, but, you know, if you're Africa and you're India and you're going to be put into perpetual drought, are you going to sign on to that? I mean, you think that that's a win-win? So, you know, it's kind of crazy. So like, you know, you were asking about scientific consensus. And so one of the big worries about some of these, like a geoengineering, do you think that if, as we start to get hotter and hotter and hotter, if we start approaching 4 or 5 degrees centigrade of warming on this planet here, there's going to be a lot more calls for doing something crazy, like putting aerosols up in the stratosphere. Do you think they're going to wait for 97% consensus before they jump on that and start putting aerosols up in the atmosphere? I mean, it's, you know, that whole debate about that there's not consensus, it's really just another one of those arguments of convenience. When push comes to shove, I mean, you know, I'll be talking about fracking on Friday. Do you think there's 97% consensus on fracking as a good idea amongst scientists? Probably not. And so, you know, it's there's so many different things here where we've taken action on much, much less than scientific consensus. And so that's, I don't know, that's kind of a red herring in a way, that we don't have consensus, therefore we shouldn't act. We've acted on far less information than we have about climate change right now. So anyway, when you look through all the different factors here, the adding these things up, it really matches what the temperature record is. This is sort of a graphic here that shows you the global land and ocean temperature anomalies for January and December here, and you know, from 1880 on up to where we are right now. I mean, you know, you can see that there is natural variability that happens. There is. But when you compare that to that, I mean, there's not a whole lot of doubt that something has changed.
When you're talking about anomaly, this is from the average between 1880
and present? Well, so even at 1880 here, I don't remember what the reference point is, but I mean, a lot of times they take a reference point at the start of the industrial age, like 1780 can sometimes be a reference point here too. But they basically just pick 1 year and they subtract it or everything from that year.
Oh, okay.
So they're not looking at an absolute, they're just looking at the deviation from that particular. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a funky way of doing it, but it's just to try to get everything on the same scale. And try to, I mean, it's meant to decrease the amount of confusion, but calling it anomaly, I suppose, can kind of increase the amount of confusion. But that's basically what they've done, is they've taken 1 year as a reference, and they've just subtracted everything from that year in order to get just how much the temperature has deviated from that particular one. So here's our 1 degree of centigrade, and so you can see up at the top here that we're at about a degree and a half centigrade hotter than this reference here. That's the way that you would read this. So this is what it looks like. This is a snapshot from January, December of 2015. Temperatures, land and ocean temperatures around the globe. And so in this darkest red here, we've got the warmest temperatures on record. So that's the Indian Ocean, Brazil, Pacific Ocean, the West Coast here, warmest temperatures on record. But we also have record coolest up there in the North Atlantic. And so again, this just is an indication about the complexity of the system here. So in all likelihood, that's a reflection of the slowing down of the global circulation pattern. So I've talked a little bit about how heat is transported from the equator on up to the poles. And in this region here, I mean, in the Atlantic Ocean there, it's basically done by the Gulf Stream, which works its way up along the coast and runs into Europe. But there's a driver that's pulling that Gulf Stream along. And it's basically every winter in the Arctic Ocean there, we get ice formation. And ice formation obviously is happening at very cool temperatures, but when you form ice, you also reject all the salt. And if you put more salt into the water, it makes it denser. I don't know if you've ever done that experiment or played around with salt water before, but the more salt water has in it, the more dense it gets. And so you get this brine rejection that's happening in the winter. So you're forming this really cold, salty water that's more dense than any of the water around it, and it sinks. And it sinks all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And it starts moving its way along the Atlantic Ocean toward the south here. Well, when that water sinks, it has to have water to replace it. And that's basically what the Gulf Stream is doing, is that Gulf Stream is carrying water from the equator back up to that pole to replace that water that has sunk and gone to the bottom and is moving along the bottom of the ocean. That's the global circulation pattern here. It's another one of the complications that we have in how climate change works. And so if you shut that off, if you shut that circulation pattern off, For example, if you don't have ice formation happening up in the Arctic, you don't have as much ice formation happening in the Arctic because it's warmer, then you don't have as much water sinking. And if you don't have as much water sinking, you don't have as much as strong a Gulf current. And so you shut down that heat going up into the North Atlantic and you end up with record cold, for example. But again, this just shows you sort of how complicated this is around, around the globe here, that we can't just we can't just expect everything to get uniformly warmer. It's obviously not going to get uniformly colder the way that we're doing it, but it impacts every area a little bit differently. Okay, I guess we should keep going. I just realized here that I'm only on slide 12 of 32, and that doesn't mean that I'm going to necessarily go through all 32 here, but we'll just keep going, plugging along a little bit more. This is just a plot here that, again, that shows temperature scaling back over 1,000 years or so. Any idea how we get these records back to 1,000 years? Again, there were no monks out there in the year 500 measuring temperature. So how do we reconstruct these temperatures?
Tree rings?
Tree rings, yeah, there's many different ways that we can do it. Tree rings is one of the ways that we can do it. We can reconstruct ocean surface temperatures, for example, from carbon isotopes in little fossils, little skeletons. Foraminifera are a single-celled organism that make a calcareous test, and depending on what the temperature is at the surface of the water, it changes the composition slightly, and so then those tests fall to the bottom and they get put into a sediment core, so we can build this big core down through there and we can measure the isotopes, the C13 isotopes of those foraminifera, and we can get an idea of reconstructing temperature. So there's a lot of different ways that we can do this temperature reconstruction, but the gist of this figure here is just that we are at the highest temperature that we've been in the last 2,000 years here. Again, just to drive home that point that things are changing. This is another plot here that shows us from, I don't know, about 1850 on up to the current year, that shows that this temperature trend here is accelerating. So we can draw the red line here at the average across this whole area versus the purple line versus the mustard line versus the yellow line here. This is sort of one of the more disturbing plots that I see on this thing, is not just the fact that it's going up, but that it's starting to accelerate and it's going faster. And this is when because all those feedbacks are starting to kick in. When we put CO2 up in the atmosphere here, it starts to increase the temperature. When you increase the average temperature, you start to get more evaporation from ocean, from the water. You start to put more moisture up in the air. You put more moisture up in the air, then that starts to trap more heat. Water is one of the greenhouse gases as well. So you start putting more water in the air, you start to trap it, and you start getting these feedbacks that build up here. So that CO2 impact is being leveraged by other feedbacks along the way here that make it worse.
Melting sea ice is another one that does.
What's that?
Melting sea ice.
Yeah, melting sea ice, because you're changing the albedo, so you warm things up, you melt the sea ice, you've decreased the albedo, so you're reflecting less energy back into the sun, or up into space. So yes, there's just all these different feedbacks that happen, and so even if we were to cap and just eliminate all CO2 right now, the temperature would still start to go up as all these different feedbacks start to kick in and cycle. So there's not an instantaneous response in how the globe reacts when you do these massive global scale changes on it. It takes some time for them to happen. Another indicator here, just trying to drive home the point that what we're looking at here is human-derived, anthropogenically derived here. So on this top here, in black, we have the observed temperatures. In red and blue here, we have two models that have been run based to try to mimic temperatures. And it's all natural forcing, so basically just changes in the sunlight and some other things that are happening here. And so you can see that there's a gap here, that we, with these models here, when we run them with just natural forcings, we can't account for this increase in temperatures, just using all the natural drivers of climate change. It doesn't work. But when you add in the natural plus the human forcings, then we're getting really, really good with these models here. We still haven't accounted for everything here, but the only thing that can account for this increase in temperature here are these human drive forcings that we have to take those into account. It just doesn't work. Some other indications about how things have changed on this globe here. This is a changes in soil moisture from the year 1900 to 2002, so a 100-year change. So this is a proxy for changing precipitation here, and you can see, again, this is not a global average here. There's different areas that are impacted more. So changing soil moisture here in Central Africa is a lot more drastic. If you're down in Argentina, on the other hand, you've got more precipitation that's happening here. We're kind of in the West here, we're more or less sort of neutral over those 100-year patterns, but you can see that we've got, on average, we've got more soil moisture here in the Mississippi River drainage basin, for example. So this is over the last 100 years. We can look at some of these other times. So this is where we start to get the weight of just cumulative evidence that's building toward the impact here. So up in the top, we've got the land air surface temperature. There's four different data sets that go into that to document the fact that we've got this increasing land air surface air temperature. We've got the sea surface temperature, five data sets here that are put together here to show that we've got this increasing trend that's happening. Marine air temperature, also increasing. We've got this one is the sea level anomaly. So we've got sea level rise that's happening over time. The summer Arctic sea ice extent, our ice in the Arctic is dropping. Our glacier mass balance, three different data sets that all demonstrate that the glacial mass balance is dropping. Northern hemisphere snow cover here, I mean, there seems to be some indication that it's dropping here, but that one's a little bit more ambiguous. We've got specific humidity that seems to be increasing, which is what you would expect with higher temperatures, more evaporation, more moisture going up into the air. The second one from the bottom, ocean heat content. All this, we basically are putting more and more heat into the ocean, and that leads to bigger and bigger hurricanes, more hurricanes. I mean, hurricanes are basically feeding off the heat of the ocean. That's what builds a hurricane, is that it's sucking heat out of the surface of the ocean, and when you run those hurricanes over the top of a hot ocean, they get more and more energy built up into them. Tropospheric temperature, so that's the lower part of the atmosphere again. All seven different data sets that show that the temperature is increasing. This is one looking at, this is related to sea level rise here and other things here, but this is showing the ice, the land-based ice on Antarctica and Greenland. Those are the two biggest, that's where most of the sea ice or most of the land ice is located here. And so there's a little bit of ice gain that's happening on, I don't know if that's north or east or west or south Antarctica. I have no idea what the directions are in Antarctica, but the top of Antarctica seems to be gaining a little bit of ice, but that's more than offset by the amount of ice that's being lost here on the left side of Antarctica. And of course, Greenland, as you know, has been just losing tons and, lots and lots of ice here. So this is a figure here that shows the cumulative ice mass loss over time. So this is all glaciers around the globe. That's how much ice has been lost, including the Lyman Glacier here in our valley. We've got Greenland here in green. We've got Antarctica here in blue. And so as the temperature of the globe is warming up here, we're losing all of this ice, this land-based ice. So this is another plot that sort of looks into the future. And this basically shows what the projections are for, or the potential projections, what things could look like in the year in the 2080 to 2100. And this is a little bit of a complicated plot here. The units are in degrees centigrade per degrees global mean change. So essentially, what it tries to capture is, I guess one way to read it is like, if we increased the temperature of the entire globe on average by 1 degree C, this map here would represent how much the temperature exchange we would expect to happen around the globe. So if the globe was increased by 1 degree C, this darkest place here would be 2 to 2.25. And you can see the Arctic Ocean up there is the heaviest, most heavily hit there. So basically the temperature up in the Arctic is going to double or triple whatever changes we have down at lower latitudes. And that's why the Arctic Ocean is sort of like the canary in the coal mine. And so there's a lot of research and a lot of focus in trying to understand what's going on in the Arctic Ocean, because that's the harbinger for what's going to happen to the rest of the planet later on. But that's the really sensitive region of the globe, and a lot of it has to do with the sea ice, the fact that we're losing sea ice, and so we've got that strong feedback that's happening up in the Arctic. But that's the region there, as we heat that Arctic Ocean, that's what's going to shut down ocean circulation, that's what's going to lead to the Gulf Stream potentially shutting down, and other warm water currents shutting down around the globe. But you can see that it's regional. That's what I'm trying to say. It's a regional effect here, and so that's one of those things that gets a little bit confusing, calling it global warming, but you've got certain areas that are not warming at all. And again, so as this thing, so up in the North Atlantic, that's sort of one of the only places on this plot here that you can see some white. And again, that's related to this phenomenon of shutting down ocean circulation and shutting down the Gulf Current, for example. So, if we increase the temperature by 2 degrees globally, then the Arctic is going to warm by 4 to 5 degrees. If we increase the temperature globally by 4 degrees, then the Arctic would be expected to go up by 8 to 10 degrees. And so it's just going to be a massive problem for the Arctic Ocean, whatever happens down here too. But current projections right now are based on business as usual, that by the year 2100, the global average temperature is likely to change from the average of 4 to 6 degrees centigrade, which would put it at about 10 degrees. So if you can imagine everything being 10 degrees hotter than what it is right now. It doesn't take a degree in science to understand what 10 degrees hotter will do for crops, and the likelihood of massive heat waves that'll just destroy crops. It's 10 degrees warming is something that I think everybody can relate to. A degree or two, I think, is a little bit harder to convince people that there's a problem. But when you start talking about 10 degrees of warming, everybody knows what 10 degrees means in terms of how much different our life will be.
And species extinction.
Yeah, and species extinction, the whole works. So this is a model of precipitation changes based on the changing heat bunches and where all of the energy is going here. And again, you see some regional differences in the precipitation. So this is the same kind of a concept here. The percent change in precipitation per degree global mean change. So if we if we have 1 degree of change in the temperature, there are certain regions here we would expect to get about 12% more rain. And so we've got Antarctica, sort of at the equator up there, the Arctic Ocean, everything.
Does the Arctic seem to be more affected by this than Antarctica?
Yes.
Because the sea ice is changing the albedo.
It's water.
I think it's part of it is the fact that it's just open ocean on the Arctic versus Antarctica, which is land-based. I think that's one aspect of it, but it's also just ocean circulation patterns as well. So the ocean is redistributing heat, and up in the Arctic there you've got a closed-in basin, so it's a lot harder to get water in and out. So I mean, it'd be sort of like a bathtub. Or a swimming pool that, here you've got free exchange of the water with all the other oceans, and so I think you get a lot more thermostatting that's happening in the Antarctic region here. I mean, there's a circumpolar current that just rolls around and rolls around and rolls around Antarctica, and it's drawing in water from these different ocean basins here, whereas up in the Arctic, the only way really to get into the Arctic is up through the Bering Strait. So there's a little bit of water that goes in through the Bering Strait up into the Arctic Ocean, and then there's a little bit of water that comes down through the Fram Strait on the other side, but otherwise it's just a bathtub sitting there getting heated up. So anyway, again, precipitation changes, and so we talked a little bit about the impact of putting aerosols up in the air and how that would change precipitation patterns around the world, and you wouldn't want to live in Africa or India if that happens. Well, even with climate change here, things are going to happen. Maybe Africa, maybe we get a little bit of the Sahara Desert back. Although 10% more of nothing is still nothing, right, in the Sahara. This is, a lot of scientists and these models, they run through all different kinds of scenarios here trying to figure out what might happen. And of course, you can make projections based on the chemistry, but you have no idea how the socioeconomic forces are going to factor into this. You don't know, for example, if our carbon footprint is going to increase or decrease, or what kind of instability is going to happen around the planet that's going to change the trajectory of it. So this plot here shows several different trajectories or different models for what might happen with the Earth. This RCP 8.5 that's in red, that's kind of the business as usual model here, where nothing really changes, where we just kind of keep going on the same trajectory that we are right now. And based on that trajectory, by the year 2100, that red diamond up there, we would have put 2,000 petagrams of fossil fuel up into the atmosphere. And our expected temperature would be on the order of 4 to 5 degrees Celsius, which would be on the 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. Most scientists, I guess probably not 97%, but there is some general consensus that if we could keep our total cumulative emissions below 500, then we would be, have the reasonable opportunity or reasonable chance of being able to adapt. It wouldn't be catastrophic. We wouldn't hit those tipping points that would cause catastrophe all around the world. Currently, we're at about 400, so we've put about 400 total in. So if we wanted to stick to that 500 level here in order to kind of lock in about a degree and a half of warming, we only have about 100 petagrams left that we can put in up into the atmosphere. Unfortunately, the proven reserves of oil and gas and coal at around 2,500. And so, there's the potential that we could use it all and put it all up into the atmosphere. And if we put it all up into the atmosphere, of course, that would be a global catastrophe. So, that's kind of the crisis that we're faced with here right now. And so we want to stop before we get to 500. And we have 2,500 that our oil companies have identified as fossil fuel that we can burn, that they can pull it out and we can do it. So, that's the real moral dilemma here, is how do we shut ourselves off before we get past that 500 here? And so here are some different scenarios for how it would work. If we go all the way to 1,000 petagrams here, well, then there's like a 90% certainty that we've locked in 3 degrees of warming. This particular plot doesn't go beyond that here too, but, so that's doubling it to about 1,000. So 3 degrees would translate to 5 to 6 degrees of Fahrenheit of warming. It's a race. It's an urgent race right now where we've got a budget. We've got a certain amount that we can burn and no more if we want to stay within manageable levels. And so, how to get there is tricky. So this RCP 2.6 thing, that one is one where we take more aggressive actions on here. It's not shutting it off right now, but we take a little bit more aggressive action on that one. And so that one is in this scenario right here, where by the year 2100, we would have basically injected about 800 petagrams of carbon into the atmosphere, and we would have locked in about 1.5 to 2 degrees of warming at that point, but it would still keep going up as some of these feedbacks kick in here too. So, that sort of basically shows you the range of options here. We don't want to be that. That's where we're headed right now. This would be better than that, but it's still not ideal. It's a pretty dire situation right here if we don't take action, if we don't take this on. And I guess, I have many, many different things that I think as a scientist. One of the things that I believe is that everything that we have done, everything that we have accomplished as a human species means nothing if we don't take this challenge on and beat it. This makes everything else that we've done irrelevant, in my opinion. And so it's again, I feel like there's this moral imperative that we have to take this on and do it and get it right. And it's so frustrating to me because we have the tools to do it. We don't need a technological miracle. We already have all the technology in place to get it done. It's here. That's not to say that more technology wouldn't make it better and easier to get this done, but we don't need to wait. There's no reason to wait for something to come along. We can do it now. And it's just, though it's very, very frustrating for me to see the inactivity and sitting on the sidelines and not doing anything and not pushing forward with this when it's so urgent to get it done right now, and then we don't. It's one of the reasons why I'm also not a climate change scientist, because I don't know how those folks can live in this world every day of their life and do this kind of research and teach it all the time here too. So I teach it like once a quarter, and it's enough to set me off for a week or so while I try to kind of, you know, decompress from it and move on to something else. But I can't live in this world here. It's just too hard. But you know, things need to happen. Moving on, here's sea level issues. As we start to take all that water and all that heat and we put it into the water, well, heat makes the water expand, so that's going to increase sea level. As we start to melt all these glaciers, as we continue to melt glaciers and we melt these ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica, all that water goes into the ocean and raises sea level. And so this is about where we are right now in terms of changes in sea level. Since 1700, we're about 30 centimeters. Is that right? 30 centimeters. Yeah, there's 100 centimeters in a meter. Yeah, 30 centimeters or so above where we were in the year 1700. Projections out to 2100 have us going on up to 1.2 meters or so, 1 to 1.2 meters on average of sea level rise. But just like climate change, this is not a global average. There are certain parts of the world that are going to be impacted a lot more than other parts of the world, just based on ocean circulation and prevailing wind patterns and changes in the magnetic field and changes in the density. There's lots of different things that, I mean, you know, sea level, it seems pretty easy. You just put some more water into the thing and everything goes up, but it's a lot more complicated in the global system here, depending on how things happen. So this area of the world here is going to be impacted a lot more than, for example, the West Coast is going to be impacted by sea level rise. So when people tell you, well, you know, what's this about climate change? Nothing has changed in California. Well, that's true. Nothing really has changed in California in terms of sea level rise. It just hasn't gone up very much. So this on these plots here around there, I mean, that those correspond to the different cities that are listed on this map. And so the red shows you what the global mean sea level change has been. And then these dashed lines here show you what's actually happening local. So for example, in the town of whatever that is called, city Antofagasta, there really hasn't been any change at all. On the other hand, if you go into Manila in the Philippines here, you can see that the sea level rise has been going up pretty drastically. Yeah?
Can I ask what causes like the sea level to decrease in some areas as it increases in others?
Again, some of it has to do with prevailing winds. And so the prevailing winds, for example, they go east. And so as you start to blow water away from the west coast of the U.S. toward the other side of the ocean here, I mean, basically it's enough to just stack the water up on the western side, for example. So again, you know, as you put more energy on the globe, you're going to increase the winds and the wind strength. And so that's just one of those things that sort of, you get those kinds of feedbacks. Response times of the Earth to CO2 pulses. So these are a couple of different scenarios here. This first one in black here, this shows you what would happen if you put 100 petagrams of carbon up into the atmosphere. And years after the CO2 pulse here, so this is in percent on the y-axis here, so 100% up at the top here. So after about 40 years or so, if you had 100 petagrams in the air here, 60% of it would be scrubbed out of the atmosphere. If you go 1,000 years out here, you've scrubbed about 85% of it out of the atmosphere. If we put 5,000 petagrams of carbon up into the atmosphere, then things change a little bit here. So again, after 1,000 years here, you've only removed about 60% of that carbon from the atmosphere. So we're talking about, it's not that it won't change, it's not that the carbon won't get pulled out of the atmosphere here, but we've locked it in. It's not all going to disappear in our lifetime, for example. I mean, that's 1,000 years out, and you've still got 40% of it left in the atmosphere. Here's a more geologic perspective on the response time of CO2 in the atmosphere. So this is a scenario in which all known fossil fuel is combusted within the next short little time here. That would push our atmospheric concentrations up to over 1,400 parts per million. Right now we're at about 400 parts per million. Over the first 300 years, we would decrease it by about two-thirds. And this is just simply from acid-base chemistry, all that CO2 being absorbed by the ocean. Then over the next 5,000 years or so, we've got these reactions with calcium carbonate, either on land or in the ocean. As the CO2 goes down to the ocean, it reacts with the calcium carbonate on the bed, and it forms bicarbonate, and that pulls a molecule of CO2 out of the atmosphere. But over the long term here, we need these reactions with igneous rocks that takes on the order of 400,000 years to scrub this all out. So, you know, here we are 25,000 years out from this big pulse here, and we would still have a significant amount of that CO2 that's left in the atmosphere. So it's not as simple as the ozone layer, where we can just shut off the CFCs and the ozone layer repairs itself over the span of 100 years or so. You know, the only way that we can really undo this is if we did come up with some sort of a miracle technology to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and bury it somewhere. But I don't know that that exists, because that takes a whole lot of energy. And where are you going to get that energy from? I mean, most likely from the sun, but we already have plants that do that. And we're not going to do better than plants at pulling energy out, pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. So, I mean, you know, my solution is that we need trees that sink. Fast-growing trees that sink, that we can carry over the Marianas Trench and then just drop them. That would be the best way that we could pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. I mean, I don't know that there's going to be any technology out there. I mean, you know, science fiction, I would have these little robots that would go around there, and they would just basically be pooping little graphite pellets onto the ground over time and sort of pull it out, and maybe you could get it by an army of those things around. I mean, you know, this sounds good in some sense, that we can at least get it down by two-thirds over the course of 300 years. But we haven't even talked about ocean acidification yet today. And this is the scenario about what happens with ocean pH. I mean, even without the climate change issue here, ocean acidification is a global catastrophe. And it gets overshadowed because we spend so much time thinking about the climate change, and we should. I mean, the climate change issue is horrific, and it's big, and we need to deal with that here too. But the ocean acidification part is just a mess. You know, all these organisms that rely on building calcareous tests, calcium carbonate tests, as the ocean pH drops down, they can't do that anymore, or it's a lot harder for them to do it, and it's kind of. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, so it's like we tend to look at the effects of things like that on the adult species. The adults of these different species are able to cope a little bit better, but it's like the juveniles that have a harder time being able to cope. So, you know, it's like there are going to be no adults if the juveniles can't survive, for example. So we've got this scenario right now where, I mean, the global surface pH here of 8.2, we've dropped it down to about 8.1. As we start to put in more carbon based on these different scenarios that we've looked at before here, we could potentially drop our pH down to about below 7.8 by the year 2100. I mean, that would be a global catastrophe for coral reefs and anything that uses a calcium carbonate shell. So, I mean, it's good that we can scrub some of this out of the atmosphere and mitigate greenhouse warming here, but it doesn't come without a cost. So, just a little bit of following the money. I mean, one of my favorite lines is that people talk about how climate change scientists are just doing it because of the money. That, you know, they're just trying to protect their turf. They're doing it for the money, to get rich. And I just have to laugh at this here. You know, you look at the total revenue globally for oil, gas, and coal companies, it's greater than $2.5 trillion. If you look at the total government subsidies, these are direct subsidies, it approaches about $1 trillion annually.
For oil and gas industry.
For oil, gas, coal industry. That's how much governments are putting into these industries to develop this extraction. if you look at estimates for the total government subsidies indirect, and I mean, I guess this is government indirect, this refers to all of the basically the climate change, the environmental degradation. If you try to put some kind of a figure on what environmental, how the cost of environmental degradation, meaning increased effects of climate change and what the economic impact will be of climate change around the world and species loss and environmental degradation, all these different things here. There's a paper in 2015 that estimates that it's about $5.3 trillion annually is what these things, what these companies are getting subsidized by being allowed to just dump all this pollution up into the atmosphere. If you look at the U.S. here, the direct U.S. subsidies are about $40 billion. That's what they're getting from our government to keep doing business as usual. The total U.S. funding of all climate change research is about $2 billion annually. So yeah, climate change scientists are doing this to get rich. I mean, if they were really doing this to get to rich, this is where they would be going. They would be working for the oil and gas companies, not for the peanuts that they get working for universities, for example. So anyway, just a little bit of perspective on where money goes. A couple of internet sources that are, if you're interested in learning some more about these things here, skepticalscience.com, realclimate.org, those are a couple of websites that are updated regularly. I'm just trying to keep on top of the latest science. That's all I have for a presentation here. I mean, I'm happy to take questions at this time. I'm also happy to put up a list of the top reasons by climate deniers, or the top excuses that climate deniers have for how this isn't real. I mean, if you would like to see some of those, I could do that. But I'm happy to take questions too.
Well, now that I'm good and discouraged,
it's a depressing feel. I don't know.
It is,
I don't know
depressing,
what to tell you.
But can you tell us five? Can you tell me four or five things I could do maybe to help? Is there anything?
Yes, of course there's a lot of things that you can do. But fundamentally, we have a broken system, and we need to fix the system if we're going to make headroads on this. I mean, you know, of course you can reduce your own carbon footprint. You can do that, and I absolutely would encourage you to do so. But it's really hard to be able to reduce your carbon footprint when you don't have the support system in place that you need. You don't have the infrastructure in place that you need. I mean, I would love to be able to, go and ride my bicycle to the grocery store and all the time and be able to get my groceries that way. While they're A, not building the right bikes for me to do that, and B, I still have to compete with the cars, and it's not very convenient to do that, for example. So, putting solar panels on every roof, where it makes sense, I guess. You know, things like that to be able to decrease your carbon footprint. Driving less, obviously. I mean, it's kind of a fascinating exercise to think about how the infrastructure would have to change in order to make a real difference in terms of the carbon footprint. Obviously, we would have to spend a lot less time driving in our cars, and mass transportation would have to be much, much bigger. But again, we would need the support for that. I mean, just telling you to get out of your car and stop using your car right now is not very realistic, because we don't have the infrastructure in place to support you on that. And so, you know, there would have to be a massive investment in building up global transportation, or global, you know, mass transit, or wherever it needs to be, so that hypothetically we would never ever drive more than like 50 to 100 miles in our own vehicle, and they would be electric.
In our household, three people go to church and three cars go to church too, depending on, because we all have different times to be there or different times to be done. And so
I mean, it's daunting, and I think a lot of it, you know, I mean, it's going to take it's not a technological fix. We have the technology. It's really a cultural economic fix, and so it really starts by lobbying our government and having them take us seriously about what it is that we want and what it is that we need for the future. I mean, that's really what it takes.
World voters. Yeah. That's about what I was going to say. Is we have to change our whole system and either get actively involved in that, mm-hmm. or support those who are to help change this whole system off of fossil fuels.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, and again, I believe strongly. I don't want to use that word. I think strongly that the science on this is correct. That it's that everything that I've talked about here, and to the best of what we've been able to do, that we have a really good handle on what's causing the climate change and where this is all headed. At the same time, I love being able to get in my car and drive off and go on a hike whenever I want to. I love being able to, you know, have chocolate whenever I want to. I love being able to, in the middle of the winter, when I'm feeding myself stress eating, I love to be able to go and get grapes that have been shipped from Chile. Mm-hmm. I love being able to do that stuff. And so, you know, it's inconvenient for me too. And I have all these different things that I really love that have a high carbon footprint on them. And it frustrates me. So it's not trivial. It's the changes that would have to happen. I mean, one of the things that I would love to see is that every product that you buy should have a carbon footprint label on it and a water footprint label on it, so that we can actually make some real decisions about what it is that we're buying and how we're doing these things. I mean, it's like if you put two things together and one of them has double the carbon footprint of the other, I trust that 90% of the people would pick the one that's got the lower carbon footprint. 90, maybe 80. Maybe 80%. But I mean, I trust that, you know, so part of it is information that, you know, just changing the culture here. I think that it's more having a connection from what it is that we're doing and what the impact is somewhere else. I mean, there's this concept of sacrifice zones, and everything that you do, there's a sacrifice zone for it. You know, I get in my car and I drive, well, there's a sacrifice zones there. There's the Alberta tar sands there's the fracking in North Dakota. That's contributing to the gasoline that's going in my car. So somewhere, someplace else, a landscape is suffering, there's the people that are suffering, there's wildlife that's suffering for something that I'm doing. I drive a Chevy Astro van, so somewhere there's a mountain that's got big gash in it from the amount of, you know, for to get the iron ore out of there and the other metals out there in order to build my van. So there's a sacrifice zone for that. I have to eat. I like to eat. It's, you know, it's eating's good. It keeps me alive. But agriculture, first of all, you've taken pristine lands, forests, or grasslands, or something like that, that has a thriving ecosystem on it, and you've converted it. You've taken away an ecosystem for a whole for all the plants and animals that were there before. And so you've destroyed that ecosystem. But now your agriculture also has runoff that's contributing to pollution in the water. I mean, there's 80,000 water bodies here in the U.S. that are listed as impaired. And four out of the top five reasons for those impairments are agriculture. So when I eat food, there's a sacrifice zone. There's polluted water because I'm eating food. And I think that we sort of lost that connectivity between our actions and what's happening out on the planet. And I think so part of that, I think, we would make better choices if we had better information. And that carbon footprint, that water footprint thing on products that we buy, products that we use, that would be one thing that would help us, I think, be a little bit more connected and probably reduce the amount that we use. I think information is very potent in that sense. But ultimately, I mean, so tomorrow evening there's that we're going to be watching a film called This Changes Everything, and it's a movie. It's based on the book by Naomi Klein. And then the whole premise of that book is this idea that, you know, we cannot trust the economic system that created this mess to fix this mess. We need to flip it upside down and we need to change it. And that's the whole premise of that book. So, I mean, that's a great book to read if you're interested in doing 460 pages of light reading. I condensed it down to about a 30 page excerpt of it, and I don't know where those are posted or how you get access to that right now.
I'm going to have at least two copies in the library, and I can get that done in about a day. If we need to make more, we can.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, that's something that you can do. I don't know. Other questions? Is that four or five, or is that...
Oh, that's...
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just kind of
want to
add to that,
because
I feel like changing an entire political system can be kind of daunting also. And like,
a little bit.
How can I do that? But something I like to think about is, like, okay, I'm one individual, and, like, maybe it's okay, I buy a plastic water bottle to use like just once and like kind of one of those disposable plastic water bottles. Mm-hmm. But if I stop and I think, okay, I'm just one person, what's one plastic water bottle? But then if I stop and think, if there are 1 billion people who are going to use one plastic water bottle in one day, but then they decide not to, that's 1 billion plastic water bottles that don't need to be made out of petroleum. So like even just those small decisions, like as an individual, it may seem like what's the point, but it kind of helps me think about, well, if we all as individuals decide, maybe not.
So if I eat one less grape from Chile every year, it won't make a difference.
Yep.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm on the Holden board, and this has not gone unnoticed by us, because our water comes from mostly snowpack. And so we've looked sort of to the future and sort of said, we can't deal with this right now. Reclamation or remediation was enough. But there is a possibility that Holden, being dependent upon hydropower, could have problems down the road.
For power or from water?
For lack of water.
Yeah.
From the snowpack.
Yeah. Do you have a question? There was a question over here too. Oh yeah.
It seems to me it gets even more complex in a culture where people are crying for jobs, and if we say eat only globally, then the whole transportation industry starts saying,
Well, I mean, that's kind of a drop. Jobs change. Jobs, you know, it's like the coal industry has gone in great decline. And while, I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs from when the coal industry has gone belly up, well, I mean, where did they go? They transfer over into the renewable sector, for example. And so, you know, you energy is energy, and we still need energy to exist and do what we do here. And so if you stop using fossil fuels and use renewable energy, well, that's still got all the jobs. And it's got, I mean, it's a different kind of job, but it's still all jobs. And so you're basically just transferring jobs from one sector to another sector. One sector is declining, another sector is growing. And we go through those kind of transitions all the time in our economy too. So I mean, that's a little bit of a red herring there when they throw that idea out there, that somehow this is going to cost us jobs, because we all still need the energy. It just needs to come from a different place, and then people need to move accordingly. I mean, I know that sounds easy because I'm not one of the ones who's going to be transitioning, but those kinds of those transitions happen all the time. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you think that living in a city that's really dense is a lot better thing to do, since you're not spread out and having to drive everywhere?
It depends on how you live in that city. If it's based more like on the European model, where the city centers are thriving and people want to live close to the cities, and so they're doing a lot more walking and bicycling for their lifestyle, then yes, it can work. If you're here in the U.S., where our cities tend to be kind of a blight and everybody flees to the suburbs and then drives their car an hour and a half each direction to commute, then no, it's not a good plan. So it really depends on how well you plan your cities. I mean, folks over in Europe, a city dweller in Europe, it's somewhere like on the order, their carbon footprint is like a quarter to half what a city dweller here in the U.S. is, because their cities are built more around that as a lifestyle, and they don't live out in the suburbs, they aren't doing their driving, plus they have better mass transportation there as well too.
Yeah.
So I think that there are certain economies that you can get in a city, but you have to, you can't, it has to be planned.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that sort of scares a lot of the free market people, the free market advocates here, is the fact that you talk about planning anything and they run scared. They want the market to decide everything. And I think that's sort of unrealistic to let the market decide everything, because the market is so short-sighted in a lot of ways. They're not thinking about 100 years out. They're not making plans to 2100. They're making plans to the next quarterly report. And so I think that, you know, that would be some of the momentum that you would have to overcome in this country, is that as soon as you start talking about planned, there would be a lot of resistance that would go along with that. But yeah, I think cities, if they're well planned, could be part of the solution. But then, you know, then you still got the issue then that you start to truck in food from everywhere. And so, I mean, that's where you need the economists to come in there and try to figure out where the best compromise is between transportation and moving resources around, and how you make that work. I don't know. It's an interesting discussion to have. You know, the idea, like, if you could only eat foods that are grown within 400 miles or 300 miles or 200 miles of where you live, what would you miss the most?
Yeah. about vegan over, I mean vegetarian, vegan over
Yeah, that's huge.
I mean, that's obviously that's a big thing as well here too. I mean, there are certain landscapes that are not suitable for doing row cropping, and so there are certain landscapes where you can justify, you know, letting free range ranching occur. But yes, if people ate a lot less meat and turned more toward plant-based things, that would have a big impact. Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, one of the kind of depressing stats that I heard is if there's not enough. And I don't remember what the units are. I'll have to see if I can dig up the units. But it's like, you know, here in the U.S., the average person over their lifetime their carbon footprint is about 10,000 of something. And I can't remember what it is. 10,000 tons doesn't sound right. That sounds like it's too low. But I have to see if I can dig up the units on that. If you do, you know, if you live the best lifestyle you possibly can, the lowest carbon footprint lifestyle you can in this country, you're only going to reduce your carbon footprint by about 5%, 5 to 10%. And so, you know, it's sad to say, but one of the ways that you can reduce your carbon footprint overall is not having as many children, for example. I mean, you know, it's just like the difference between, I mean, overpopulation on this planet here is a huge issue as well. We haven't even talked about that, but right now we're at 7.3 billion people, and the current projections are that we're going to hit 13 billion by the year 2100. What are we going to do with twice as many people on the planet? I mean, that's an issue all in itself that has to be. So that's some of those socioeconomic issues that we have to deal with in terms of, you know, why it makes it so hard to project exactly what's going to happen with the CO2 footprints and climate change here in general. We don't know for sure what our population is going to be in 2100. I mean, it makes a big difference if it's 9 billion versus 13 billion, for example. So then, you know, you want to know what to do. Well, one of the things that you do is you provide education and career opportunities for women around the globe. And that tends to drastically reduce birth rates, for example. It drastically slows down the population growth. And so if you can provide, you know, education opportunities and careers for women around the world, I mean, that would significantly help this climate change effects.
Isn't there some statistic a child born in the United States uses the resources of 400 children born in Africa or something like
70
that?
Times.
I don't know the
something
numbers,
like
but,
that. Yes,
but
there is some statistic about that.
There's two sides to this.
So the overpopulation in Africa isn't impacting the world.
Right. Yeah. I don't want to point to anyone. Yeah, I don't want to pigeonhole any particular countries about that either. Too. I mean, it's a global issue. Again, you're right. So depending on where those children are born, has a big impact too on what the carbon footprint is. But it's, you know, so it's there's so many different facets to how to tackle this on. But like the population issue, I mean, again, we already have 80,000 water bodies in the U.S. that are impacted and a huge chunk of those are related to agriculture. And so if we double the population of the planet and we increase agriculture accordingly, then how much more water contamination is that going to be? We're sort of straying a little bit here from the climate change thing here, but it's just, you know, there's so many different interrelated things here. But anyway, the point that I was just going to try to make is that why isn't population in the narrative? Why is that nothing that we talk about? It's such a taboo subject to talk about population growth and ways to try to address it, but we don't.
We used to.
Yeah, I mean, in the late 60s and in the 70s, you know, the population bomb came around, and you know, that's why our younger sister was adopted. My mom read that book, and she decided she still wanted to have another. They still wanted to have another kid, and so our sister was adopted, and that's kind of the story about how that happened. So that was the population bomb, that particular book. Yeah, we used to talk about it, but somewhere along the way we stopped. And it's kind of curious to me, and so it's like, anyway, I don't need to go down there. But like,
it's not that easy though, because the United States, Europe, Japan, Russia, their replacement rate is actually below 2. They're below 1 right now.
Yeah.
You look at China and India, it's the opposite. So you have to look at the countries. It's not a simple answer.
No, China's low.
China is pretty low at this point, yeah. No, you're right. It's there's this multifaceted, but the point is that we're not talking about it at all right now, and we need to be. And of course, it's a global issue again, and I think that's the thing. It's like we can't, we've got this imbalance. We've got some countries that have developed and some countries that are not very well developed, and they should be able to develop, but you know, we need to be able to support them in an environmentally friendly way, an ecosystem friendly way, to be able to allow them to still develop. We can't just tell developing countries you can't do any more carbon footprint. You're done. We're all just going to shut it off, and you're locked into whatever your economic lifestyle is forever and ever. I mean, that's not very ethical, moral either. So everything that we're talking about in here is really, it's a global solution and or a global problem, and we need global solutions. And I think that's one of the things that's also in our way, trying to get all these countries to work together in the same direction. I mean, it happened with the ozone layer. It did. But we're talking about a big problem here. Any other questions?
No, the only one that I thought about too you didn't mention, and that is things like the Amazon and the deforestation
right.
of
mm-hmm.
the world, right, which certainly contributes to this as well.
Yeah. Oh, I had a stat for that too. What am I thinking about? So there's an excerpt from This Changes Everything, the one that I put together. There's a little bit of stat in there about how much deforestation adds to the carbon in the atmosphere too. So I don't remember what it is just off the top of my head, but it's in there. If you go have a peek, you can find it. Question.
Do you have advice for remaining optimistic in the midst of acknowledging all of this sadness?
Yeah. I'll be dead in 2081, so I won't experience it.
There are hopeful things that are happening now.
Yes, I mean, so the movie Tomorrow, This Changes Everything, that's sort of an idea about reasons for optimism. And one of it, so I was talking a little bit about sacrifice zones before. It's easy to ignore and not worry about sacrifice zones when it's happening somewhere else and you don't see it and you're not connected with it. But I think one thing that's happening now is that those, you know, as we've picked all, plucked, we've extracted all the cherry resources, and now we need to find new areas, and those new areas are starting to encroach on us. And so the whole theme of this film Tomorrow is this idea that as these sacrifice zones are getting closer and closer to us, as they become more real to us, we're going to be more willing to fight back. And as once we start fighting back against these, these sacrifice zones that are encroaching upon us, then that's when you start to build the momentum that you need to change the system and make things better. So, I mean, I think the answer here is that it's going to have to get better or get worse before it gets better. Can I use your chocolate chip cookies analogy now or not? No, I'm not going to. Never mind.
It's a different topic.
It's an inside joke. So I think that things are going to have to get worse probably before they get better. But I think the answer to the hope there is that it is becoming more real. We are starting to all personally experience it more, and the more that it impacts each of one of us, the higher our, the more likely we are to act on it, and I think that's where it's going to come from. I mean, unfortunately, that just seems to be the way it works. It has to become personal before we act on it. But I think the good and bad news is that it's getting more personal a lot sooner than we want it to.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else? I guess we're at time here, and it's the dinner bell is ready to go. What's up?
Thank you. To see the list.
Oh, sure. I can put that up.
Can you email that to me?
The list?
Yeah.
It's on skepticalclimate.
Oh, okay.
So here's the top 10 climate myths. Climate's changed before, so this is just more of the same old. It's the sun the sun has increased its radiation, so we've shown
these are the responses to it on the right.
That's just a rough. But if you go to the actual, so what is, yeah, this one is from, I guess it does it's know, somewhere on here, I thought I had the address on this. Okay, there it is. Huh. So usually when I do the printout of this, it shows the website, but this is this one here is from Skeptical Science. And so there's a, I mean, there's just a link on there that talks about the most common climate change myths. So if you go to that website here, I mean, the one in the red is that shows what the argument against climate, or, you know, the denial argument would be. And on the blue is sort of the short thing, but if you click on the blue there, it gives you a much more expanded explanation for how it works. So number three is, it's not that bad. That yes, it's increasing, but it really isn't increasing enough to cause any problems. Well, that's just because they don't live in those islands that are about ready to go underwater, for example. There is no consensus. Well, I guess, you know, 97% versus 3%. I guess for some people that's not good enough, but that's where we are. It's cooling. You know, there was some ambivalence in the records. Well, I mean, that's a myth. The last 10 years have been the hottest on record. Models are unreliable. Well, they can successfully reproduce the temperature since 1900 globally. I mean, not perfectly spot on, but they're getting really, really good. And as we increase our scientific understanding, the models are getting better and better all the time. The temperature record is unreliable. This is the idea here that you know, those reconstructions that we do aren't really telling the truth. But we have so many different ways of measuring these temperature anomalies there, and they're all lining up. And so it's hard, you know, if it was just one, you could make that argument. But when it's a bunch of them, it makes it a lot harder to do that. Animals and plants can adapt. Well, that's not really true, because we've put up fences and we've put up boundaries. And the way that animals and plants have to adapt is they have to move north. Well, they can't move north because, you know, we here in this country, for example, I mean, we've got our national parks. Where are they going to move north to? You know, from Yosemite, are they going to jump across to Lassen, and then from Lassen they're going to jump up to Crater Lake? It just doesn't work that way. So expecting plants and animals to be able to move north and follow the climate change north doesn't really work very well. And so, you know, we're basically right now in the midst of the greatest extinction event on the Earth. The rate of extinction right now is faster than anything that's ever happened before. So that's kind of a silly thing to say. It hasn't warmed since 1998. So I don't know.
I have a gentleman who literally has a National Geographic from the 70s that predicted the Ice Age and said, see, they were wrong now, so why should we?
Well, there were some that did, yeah. but and so a lot of times they highlight that most scientists at that time were predicting warming. So the consensus even back then was still warming. There was just some that weren't as convinced. Antarctica is gaining ice. Well, that's that other, you know, it's the type of ice that you're gaining. If it's sea ice, it's a different kind of impact than land ice. So it's losing land ice, but it's gaining sea ice at this point. Ice age predicted in the 70s, so that would be the throwback to yours. Well, the vast majority of climate papers in the 70s predicted warming. CO2 lags temperature. So there's this phenomenon here in the past when we've gone into, or when we come out of ice ages, for example, it's like the globe starts warming first and then the CO2 starts to increase. And so then the argument is, well, you know, now you're telling us that CO2 is going to increase warming, but in the past it's always lagged. So the CO2, it didn't start the warming, but it amplified it. There was a feedback in those situations that made it happen much, much more quickly. So it's not that CO2 didn't cause any warming at all. It's just it was more about the timing issue and how it worked. There's like 100 of these, and I'm sure you don't want me to read them all to you. But I can flip to the next page if you want to have a look. Climate sensitivity is low. We're heading into an ice age. Ocean acidification isn't serious. The hockey stick is broken. The ClimateGate CRU email suggests conspiracy. Hurricanes aren't linked to global warming. Al Gore got it wrong. Glaciers are growing. It's cosmic rays. 1934 was the hottest year on record. It's freaking cold. Extreme weather isn't caused by global warming. Sea level rise is exaggerated. So I don't know. There's a long list of these things here too. Anyway, now we're past.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great job.